This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
It's great to have you here on the Clark Howard Show, where our mission is to serve you and empower you so you make better financial decisions in your life. And if you haven't visited Clark.com or ClarkDeals.com lately, gosh, your life is not complete. I hope you'll visit soon. Our team works so hard to bring you great money advice that you can trust. Now, trust this. This is not my favorite day of the year. Tax day. Yuck. So I'm going to talk about taxes. First, I'm going to talk about what do you do if you don't have the money you need to pay today. Also, later I want to talk about property tax, and I can share a personal story with you. But let's deal first with today being tax day. So you're not ready, don't have your paperwork together, whatever, because a third of people leading into tax day, they haven't done their returns or they're scrambling to do them. If you're not ready, don't worry, be happy. You can file an automatic extension with the feds. You don't need permission. You just file it. And it's as if you filed on time when you do an automatic extension. And so when you do that, it gives you additional months to complete the paperwork. What it does not do is give you additional time to pay the money that you may owe. So if you just file an extension and say, I'll get around to it later, and I know I owe money, not really paying much attention to it. What happens later in the year when you do file the return, which has to be filed by mid-October, you have to pay underpayment penalties, tax and interest, for not having paid what you owed by April 15th. So if you got money, but you just haven't done the paperwork, you pay your best guesstimate of what you owe. You do that along with filing the extension. Then let me deal with a reverse situation that is a fact of life for a lot of people. Today, you owe money, you don't have it. This happens more now because of all the gig work. You know, you're getting paid 1099. You may have a regular job. They withhold tax from you. That's fine. But if you're doing gig work, you're the one who has to pay a lot of money in tax, and you may not have it today. So the way you handle that, if your return's ready, you know your return's finished, but you just don't have the money, file your return on time, even if you don't have the money. The reason is the penalty for failure to pay is much lower than the penalty for failure to file. So you always want to file the return. For years, the interest you had to pay on money you owed but you hadn't paid yet was much lower than it is now. As interest rates have gone up, that's gone up. But it's still a lot less than credit card interest, let me tell you. So file the return, send in what you can afford to, and it takes the IRS a while to get it together on billing you for what you haven't paid. Just send them money as you can over the next few months, and you'll be fine. You'll pay some interest, but nothing too terrible. The most important thing is, because you can't pay everything you owe today, don't compound it by not filing the return. Or let's put that the positive way. File your return, because it limits the economic consequences of not having all the money to pay. If you owe a lot, you can even propose your own payment plan to the IRS. It takes the IRS like a year in most cases to even answer you back on that. And whatever you propose, just pay as you proposed in that plan, and you're fine too.
All right, I'm going to start out. We're still getting a lot of questions about that AT&T breach. So people want to know, what do you think they should do? Is there an action to be taken? I want to know too.
Are you an AT&T people?
Yes, I am.
I'm an AT&T people for internet, not for cellular. Is that what you are?
Yeah.
So the AT&T breach, if you've missed this, affects 73 million or 74 million people, both current and prior customers of AT&T. AT&T doesn't even know how this breach happened, if it happened internally, if it happened externally, how the criminals got the data. They have your social security numbers. They have your current and prior addresses, apparently. They have your phone number. They have your passcode into your account. They got all kinds of deep data on you, including apparently dates of birth, everything needed. This is like, it's smaller than the horrific Equifax breach of 9 years ago, I guess it was. This is smaller. It's half the size because it's half the population. But it's even deeper data than what happened in the Equifax breach, if that's possible. So a couple of things. This is something you got to do. If you have not frozen your credit, freeze your credit with the three major credit bureaus. Very easy to do. It's free to do. It gives you the control that someone cannot apply for new credit as if they're you. Very valuable to you. Credit freezes take about 15 minutes in total to set up. If you go to clark.com/creditfreeze, you'll see how to do that. Now, here's why the AT&T breach is potentially even more dangerous. They got your phone number and all this other data. So your existing accounts are at risk. By existing accounts, I'm not talking about people you owe money to. I'm talking about money you got. Investment accounts, retirement accounts, bank accounts. They all rely on two-factor authentication. AT&T customers, past and present, should consider changing the two-factor from your cell phone number to many with two-factor authentication allow you to have a code sent to your email. Have a code sent to your email instead of to your AT&T phone, because the criminals have all that information as well. You don't want them to be able to use this as a way to hack in to your accounts. Also, if you used the same password for your AT&T sign-in as you use for your email or any financial sites you're with, brokerage, bank, investment, retirement, anything like that, change your password with any of those entities, email, all of those are key. Because if a criminal has been able to get your AT&T password, you don't want them to then be able to try it at Fidelity or Vanguard or your bank or wherever. So this one requires action, not passivity.
Mm-hmm.
Because we get passive and we get zoned out about data breaches because they just keep coming at us like ocean waves. So this is one you cannot ignore and you need to get on top of. You get any strange mail about applying for new credit or anything weird that's like, why am I getting that? It may well be tied into this huge AT&T breach.
And this didn't just happen. It's been. Yeah. So yeah. If you've been experiencing these things, this could be why.
This could be a while back. It's just now we know where a lot of this weirdness is coming from. That's why for AT&T, current and past, this is very important. AT&T is going to offer the lame credit monitoring garbage. Just ignore all that and take the active steps you need to.
Sharon in New York says, I would like to start a 529 plan for each of my granddaughters. I talked with their parents about this, and they don't want to push them towards college because their mother says she doesn't even use her degree but is still paying on student loans. I explained to them about the new rules and being able to switch it to an IRA in the future if they decide not to go, but that wasn't enough. I need their social security numbers to start the plan with their names on it, and they weren't willing to give them to me. Any suggestions?
Oh, Sharon, this is tough. This is hard. I don't know how old your granddaughters are. that if the mom is like totally diametrically opposed to college, then the culture within that family unit is going to be where the kids are going to hear over the years, over and over again, growing up, college is a joke, college is a joke, college is a joke. And what's going to happen? They're going to think, oh yeah, college is a joke. That's not for me. So you're beating your head against a wall. You may not be able to get your head through. But if you want to pursue it, what you can do is you can set up more than one 529 plan. You didn't say how many granddaughters you have, Sharon, but you could set up multiple 529s, each of them naming yourself as owner and beneficiary, and then hoping against hope that later, as the kids are growing up, they will consider going to college, and then you change the beneficiary designation on each of the plans to each of the granddaughters. But you are swimming upstream here. The other alternative that would be more direct and simple, but not tax-free, is you could set up a custodial investment account for them. Like I've talked about the Fidelity Zero Funds, you could open an investment account and put money for each granddaughter in Fidelity. You'd have to have separate accounts, custodial for each grandkid. And you can put money in those. They're not going to be tax-free, but those investment accounts are very tax favorable, and the zero funds have no commissions and no ongoing expenses. So you can put them in a total market index fund or international index fund, whatever. It'll grow quite nicely over the years. And the tax bomb is not bad at all because of the structure of how those work.
But you'd need their socials for that. So the
she might give it in. Yeah, she'd give it for that.
But then also those would count against financial aid if they did go to college.
They
right?
would count against financial aid if they go to college. But the whole idea is you're trying to do generation skipping transfer
right.
of funds. So that is an alternative.
Diana in Oregon wrote in. She said, I disputed a charge for a car rental in Europe. The credit card company ruled in my favor because the rental company never responded to them. The company has now sent me a bill for the amount. Do I have to pay this? They said I damaged the rim, but I did not. Unfortunately, I took pics of the car, but not the rims. It's their word against mine. Neither one of us can provide proof. Lesson learned, include the rims and pictures, not just the nicks and scratches.
Yeah, okay, so you don't have to pay the bill to this European car rental company. They may at some point hire a collection agency to come after you. It's a foreign collection, so it's highly unlikely it would ever show up on your credit report. I've been reading on a number of sources how tough the car rental companies have become for all kinds of supposed damage to rental cars. And the number one claim today is for windshield. You're talking about the rims on the car, but the windshield letters that people are getting from the car rental agencies are crazy. Elliott Advocacy says that you want to shoot video and pictures of the whole rental car. And now as they're seeing the pattern, especially the windshield, you've brought in the rims. It costs nothing to just sit there and take 30 seconds and shoot all the way around the car. And Elliott Advocacy recommends you take a picture in addition of the windshield when you rent and when you return. And I mean, this is crazy stuff, but the car rental companies are having trouble making money these days. So they've decided that after the rental claims is a great way to make money. They often don't provide any documentation. The bills can come months later, just out of the blue, you get a bill for a huge amount of money. And that's why you need to take those pictures, shoot that video, both when you pick up and when you return, and hold it for months and months to come. I would say 6 months is a reasonable likelihood that after that you can erase. I went back and just erased some from 2 years ago that I've been holding. And I rent about 30 cars a year. So I got a lot of videos and pictures of rental cars.
I just rented a car recently and I got there and my car, they said, was going to be another hour after my reservation. So I waited patiently and there were two guys sitting there. And the one guy kept saying like, hi, is my car ready yet? Like he was so polite. And then finally, he was like, I've been waiting here for 3 hours.
Oh.
My reservation was 3 hours ago.
Oh.
And suddenly they found an upgraded car they could give him because he was like, I want a manager now. And so then they gave him an upgraded car. So it's just crazy right now. And that was the only car rental company at this particular airport that even had cars. It was just nuts.
Richmond, Virginia?
Yes, I was in Richmond.
Yeah, the smaller airport stations, this is becoming a bigger problem. But at all airports, this is a problem. So one thing you want to do with car rentals, even if you, like I'm in car rentals all the time, as I just stated, but let's say you rent cars infrequently, join the car rental company frequent renter program. They're all free to join. If you have various premium cards, you may even instantly qualify for elevated membership levels that allow you to get a car when other people can't. I remember I've shared this story before about landing in Houston, at Houston Hobby Airport. We take the shuttle bus to the car rental and I'm like, oh no, we get there. There's a line of people and I happen to be a premium member of that car rental company. And they said, people who are blah, 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 stay on the bus, you know, the level I was. And there were two of us that were that. Everybody else got off at this place. And then they were in the Hunger Games line forever. And then the two of us go to the other side. And they said, you know, go there. You get your keys. And we drove off. And I felt so guilty.
Oh, my gosh. I would have been like, if I was one of those people, I would have been like, I don't want to get off the bus.
Exactly. I mean, but that's the way it works with the car rentals. That if you're a member of their programs, you go to the front of that long queue of people waiting for cars. Is it fair? Is it right? No, but the car rental companies are purposely overbooking by very large amounts and hoping that the no-shows work out for them. But if they don't, they're like, oh, well, you know, you people are just going to wait till people come back. I've been in that before. That happened to me at Washington Dulles Airport, where we waited hours to get a car. I mean, it's a serious problem in the car rental industry. And more, I'm doing Uber and Lyft in big cities instead of renting a car. And then I don't have to deal with parking, paying for parking and all that, because the car rental industry is such a fouled up mess right now.
And I know you say Uber and Lyft, but if there's public transportation, you're taking that first.
Well, that is true. So, okay. The reality, if it's just me, I'm on public transportation. If Lane's with me, well, it depends.
Sure. It's all about compromise.
Right. So coming up ahead, I talked earlier about income tax. Since we're already talking about taxes and making it a miserable April 15th, we're going to talk about property taxes and what's going on with that across the United States.
Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49% based on creditworthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
In many states in the country, property taxes on homes go up based on what values are, in theory, on properties in that year. There are some states, some of the biggest states actually, that have caps for owner-occupied residences. Investment property, second home residence, their property value is to be marked to market, in theory, every year, and then your property taxes adjust. Well, we've had since, if you go back to prior to COVID to today, obviously, the housing affordability thing is an ugly problem in the United States for people trying to buy a home. And on paper, a huge advantage to people who owned homes prior to COVID that have seen these big run-ups in value. But now, for those who feel like, man, look what's happened. My home's gone up so much. The other shoe to drop is what you then have to pay in most states when your property is assessed and they say, oh, it's worth this much more, and you have to pay that much more tax. I just went through a process of appealing a property tax appraisal. I hired as I've done all through the years, I hired a professional firm to handle my appeal, and I lost flat out. The first time ever that I didn't win some kind of reduction in the value of the property. So now I owe a back tax bill during the appeal period, and moving forward, I owe a lot more tax each year. The reasons for appeal are that other people are of similar properties are appraised at much lower than you, or that they've just flat out outrun the market. Obviously, the board felt like the value is what I could really get for the property. I don't think so, but that's the story. And so we're going to face this in most states with the mark to market, where you either can just pay it, or if you know that for whatever reason they have over-assessed you, over-appraised your property, you want to appeal. If the money's big, you want to look at hiring the professional appeal services that you can pay one of two ways. You can either pay them an upfront fee, then a small percent of whatever money they save you, or in many jurisdictions, you can pay nothing upfront, but you give a bigger split, even 50-50, of the money they save you by getting the value reduced. But if the amounts are small, then it's really your time that is at risk if you do an appeal. The reasons, if you handle your own appeal, never talk about how government wastes your money, or you know, you don't like the county commission people or anything like that. Everything has got to be about the dollars and cents. Be polite, be clear, and be concise when you appear before a panel. Many times they will be fellow citizens that are volunteering to be on a panel, or they could be paid professionals. In every case, honey beats vinegar. Politeness, clarity, and actual facts are going to be the key. If you can show that neighbors of equivalent properties are being appraised much lower, or that the marketplace price in your development, in your area, is much lower, what people are getting for their homes, lower than what they have appraised you at, those are the grounds for appeal. If you live in a jurisdiction where your values are capped, how much they can go up each year, great for you. A lot of us aren't that lucky.
I lost my appeal too.
So we're 0-2 standing here.
We hired a guy. He was recommended on Nextdoor, but we finally wrote again, like, what's going on? And he wrote back and he's like, well, he sent us a form letter and it said, great news, you're frozen for 3 years, blah, blah, blah. But like, and you're saving by being frozen for 3 years. And we're like, so nothing. You got nothing, basically.
Nothing.
Yeah. Stinks. Yeah. Okay. Robert in Ohio says, my in-laws are retired and decided to leave their home in Florida and will be moving in with our family. They're in good health and will occupy our lower level as their own apartment with 2 bedrooms, full bath, and approximately 1,600 square feet of living space.
Wow, this is a big house. Yeah. At the lower level is 1,600 feet.
My in-laws are willing to chip in to pay their share, but are leaving the terms up to my wife and I. We are undecided on how much to charge monthly and if we should consider the mortgage, property taxes, homeowners insurance, etc. Is there a benchmark rate to land this monthly rent figure or other advice you can offer? We will have 6 total occupants in the household and therefore we are having them pay 1/3 of the utility costs. I'm also curious about tax implications, if this would positively or negatively affect our tax rate. Thanks, Clark and team.
Okay, so Robert, these situations can always be sticky because you're talking about your in-laws living in your house. So you'd have a tendency likely to undercharge them and then later potentially as an in-law resent it. And you also have the tax implications and the rest. So the rent usually would be set based on whatever your guess is of market value of renting 1,600 feet in your area, not based on your costs, expenses. The utilities, that's fine how you're doing it. Having their one-third of the residents of the property, having them pay one-third of the utilities. If you have a CPA who does tax for you, Robert, or an accountant who helps you with your tax, going to see that type of person or finding a CPA who does tax would be really useful so that you structure this right from the very beginning. If you don't have it set up in a way that would make sense, you could later potentially owe tax in a case like this because you have to treat it like an arm's length transaction. And also, you need to be fair to you and you need to be fair to your in-laws. So you brought them under your roof. They are willing and able to pay. So you want to make sure that both parties feel it's fair and understand why. And that's why you get the assistance of a third party. Now, on tax, you will be able to recategorize that percent of your house that 1,600 square feet represents as rental property. And there will be current tax advantages to being able to do that. And that's why having this set up right from up front with an accountant's help is very valuable. So you have an outsider with no axe to grind advising you properly how to structure this. And from the very beginning, the accountant is on board about what the tax benefits will be for you, that it's structured properly.
Mike in Ohio says, hey, Clark, at the recommendation of our family dentist, we're in the market for braces for my 7-year-old. We have dental insurance.
I'm so glad I'm done with all that.
Me too. We got two quotes so far, and both are charging the same initial price. However, one dentist is willing to provide a 20% discount for upfront payment in full. The other orthodontist is unwilling to offer any discounts. Unfortunately, we like the more expensive orthodontist. Any recommendations on how to get the best price? I mean, there's recently a story. I did the pay in full with, it was only a 5% discount, not 20. And
20 is pretty great.
We just recently, though, heard about someone who went out of business and then the people were on the hook.
Right. You took the words
right out of
my mouth.
I don't know what I would do today. Yeah.
That is the danger always with paying cash up front for a service that will be delivered over time. How old is the dentist offering the 20%, the orthodontist offering the 20%? Might they retire before your 7-year-old retires from braces? So the cash up front discount may not be as valuable as you think, because when a medical professional sells a practice, they sell only certain assets and they don't sell liabilities like ongoing patient care for people who pay up front. So I would not put so much value on the 20% discount because of the unknowns that come with that. If you're happier with the second orthodontist who's offering no discount, pay them over time. That paying over time gets you some percent of that cash upfront discount back anyway. You also could go to one more orthodontist, get one more opinion, see what the third orthodontist is like. Do you like the practice? Do you like the individual orthodontist? Are you happy with whatever price that third orthodontist offers? But if you're done at two, I would go with who feels like the better practice and pay over time.
Dean in Florida says, can I start a Roth IRA if I'm under 18? And what's the best company to do so? Should I change to another bank? I currently have one of the giant monster mega banks. I am also starting to learn the stock market. Should I invest for short term or long term?
Okay, first of all, Dean, you are part of a movement in the United States. There's been a shift in Gen Z where people are opening their first investment account or retirement account way younger than maybe has ever been done in modern American times. This is a fantastic thing. If you go back not that long ago, an under 18-year-old would not know what a Roth was. Today, very common that is language that's understandable to teenagers. And this is great because money invested now has so much more impact and power because of the value of time compounding the money you put in. Now, if you want to take that advantage and throw it away, you have your Roth IRA at a bank. So this is when someone should have an investment account at a bank.
Crickets.
The answer is never, 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 not ever. Banks are where you put money to have in a checking account or for short-term available savings. Never to invest. Banks are rotten, terrible, awful at investing. Even bank-based investment arms are awful because they charge very high fees and almost without exception refuse to be what's known as
fiduciaries.
Fiduciary, which is a big word that simply means legally they are required to put your interests first. The best place for an under 18-year-old to start a Roth IRA today is with Fidelity Investments. Why Fidelity? Because Fidelity allows a teen to have more control of their investment account than anybody else in the investment industry. So having it with Fidelity, you can set up your Roth IRA. I'd like for you to look at doing the Fidelity Target Index version of a fund, which for you would be like 2065, which answers the question you asked, should you invest short-term or long-term? If you're doing this as a teenager, long-term, because you want that Roth money to grow tax-free for the next 50 years. A dollar's impact today, 50 years down the road, is huge. We have a guide how to open a Roth IRA, and my favorite investment companies, we have 10 listed at Clark.com. So there's others besides my three favorite children, which are Vanguard, Fidelity, and Schwab, that you can put your money at and get it working. Fidelity requires $1 to open your Roth IRA. All you have to have, though, you have to have earned income, Dean, from a job. Remember, banks are where you have checking accounts. If you're really smart, you do that at a credit union. But if you are going to be at a bank, fine to have your checking account there, savings account, but never, never, not ever your investment account. Why do I pound that so hard? Because why are banks accounting for less and less and less and less of money in the United States? Because they're so expensive to do business with, and they're kind of stuck in a rut in their ways. That's why investment money should be with an investment house. And if you're not a long-time listener to the podcast, you may not know this. I have not had an account with a bank in decades. I even have my bank account, if you will, my equivalent of a bank account with Charles Schwab, not with a bank, because the banks just are not efficient organizations. They're expensive and they wake up every day trying to figure out how to get another fee out of your pocket. You know, I don't like pickpockets. And that's what banks wake up every day to do, is to pick your pocket.
What do you use for like Venmo? Because I know you don't, but
Lane has a credit union account into Venmo. I've never used one of the payment apps.
Yeah, I know. I have a big bank account that's like a legacy account I had when I was young that has no fees, and I use that for all my those things.
So where do you do most of your banking, though?
Charles Schwab.
Oh, you do with Schwab also? All right. So see, we've mentioned my three favorite children all in the last 3 minutes. Schwab, you know, has had a very rough 2 years because they did something very unethical, how they treated people's savings by way underpaying them interest on savings, and that cost them customer erosion. And they still have something like $8 trillion in assets on hand or something. I mean, these financial houses are so big, but they don't fee you. It's not their thing. Anyway, enough about that. What it's about is you learning ways to save more, spend less, and avoid getting ripped off. Have a great rest of your tax day.